call the meeting on the Healthcare Workforce Task Force to order. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. Our first order of business is to move the minutes that you should have in your packet on August 26th. As I mentioned, Senator Kickmeyer moves the minutes for August 26th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, the first thing on our agenda is just to get on everybody's calendar the dates for upcoming task force meetings. And the chair and I have discussed those. And the meeting dates that we have are going to be November 14th from 12:30 to 2:30. And December 6th from 10 until noon. So just want to make sure everybody has those on their calendar. And from there, we're just going to do a brief review and update. Oh, excuse me. Senator Spigman.
I think everybody wrote fast.
Absolutely. I will go through those dates just one more time. We have November 14th from 12:30 to 2:30. And December 6th from 10 until noon. And of course, those will be posted for future meeting dates as well. So with that, members, I'm going to move to the next item on our agenda, which is the review of the work plan, which you should have in your packets. Kind of keeps our eye on what we're focusing on and moving towards. And members, I'll go to Mr. Schoenbach from the Department of Health to, if there's anything that we need to know about where that work plan stands, any changes to it, and then if members have any questions. Mr. Schoenbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Schoenbach from the Health Department. Members, just first note on the minutes. You may remember that there was a discussion captured in the minutes at the last meeting on proposed rules by the Board of Nursing to allow for expanded use of simulation as a method of accomplishing clinical training, and you will find those proposed rules towards the back of your packet. Board of Nursing is here and reports that they passed the date by which hearing requests would have needed to be made, and not enough requests were received to require a hearing. So they will be proceeding to the adoption steps on these rules. So that's just for your reference. To the work plan. Members, at the last meeting, I think there was a discussion of members' interests in topics, and the draft that you have in front of us attempts to incorporate all of those topics into the work plan. There was also a discussion at the last meeting. You may recall that their preliminary work plan proposed 6 meetings, and members expressed an interest in having 5 meetings. This version has 5 meetings and attempts to squeeze everything in. In meeting 3, it begins, as Representative Albright suggested last time, your discussion of priorities for your final report moves on to review a draft of that report and have more discussion in the 4th meeting along with some topic presentations, and then perhaps there will be a meeting 5, either in person or business by email, to adopt a final report and recommendations.
Okay, members, any questions or comments? Okay, the other item on our agenda that I think would be good for Mr. Schoenbaum to cover for members briefly is the updated health workforce spending table. Members should also have that in their packet. It has a blue heading at the top. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is information that has been updated in each of your last 2 years, and was updated once again with action taken last session. In terms of spending, there was not a lot of action, but not a lot of changes to incorporate in this version. I think the most significant one I'll point out to you is in the first page, Higher Ed Division number 19, was some funding for family medicine clinical training at the University of Minnesota Medical School, $800,000. And I think that was, I think there may have been a minor cost noted for community emergency medical technician reimbursement. That's all we've come up with so far. Unless you are kind of desire something different, you know, you'll find this version or, you know, whatever corrections we make to it kind of incorporated into your final report.
Senator Kinkmeyer. Mr. Chairman, I have a question on the third page where it's under the $9.2 million that is distributed. There's a veterinary diagnostic lab. Is this for personnel? I see the word lab there. That's not the construction of a lab. Is this a veterinary technicians or veterinarians or so on, or is this for an actual lab? I'm just wondering. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Senator Kickmeyer, I don't know the answer to either. I think these are ongoing operating funds. You know, we can ask the university to confirm that for us. This page basically is kind of a detail of some of the ongoing funding that's provided to the university. In a prior year, there was like just a single line item in the higher ed budget, and university was asked to provide some details on how those funds are distributed. That's what this table represents. I believe these are all ongoing operating and perhaps minor capital changes, but I'll confirm that with the university.
Madam Chair, Senator Kinkmeyer.
I'm sure there's anybody from the university here.
Thank you.
Okay, members, any other questions regarding the table? Okay, thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum. Members, with that, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda, which is an overview and update of the health workforce landscape, and that's reviewed by the Department of Health. You may come forward. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you so much for being here.
Madam Chair. I'm Laura McLean with the Department of Health. I work in the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. And like you mentioned, I'll be giving you an overview today of the healthcare workforce.
Okay, and sorry to interrupt you. Do you have slides that we'll be following along with, or Mr. Fulman?
Now, Madam Chair, there. Okay, so I think Windows 10 may be getting the better of us.
I could just request, just for the hearing of the audience, the audio and noise greatness, if you could just speak directly into the mic, that would be helpful. Thank you.
So, like I said, that sounds better. I do have a soft spoken voice. I will be giving you an update on the healthcare workforce, and some of this information will be a refresher. Some will confirm probably what you've been working on over the past couple of years, and hopefully they'll give you takeaways for you that will be useful in your final report. So it'll be an overview of the data. We'll talk a little bit about supply and demand, and then leave you with some trends and highlights. So part of why we're all here is the importance of the healthcare industry in supporting the workforce. Over the past few years, it has had the largest growth of any U.S. industry, $2.2 million since 2007. In Minnesota, it's also a large part of the workforce, employing 15.9% of overall employment, with a growth of 4.3% in the last year. So continuing to increase even in the last year. And then looking at the makeup of the occupations, so there's a number of different occupations that make up the employment. This here is some of the key occupations, either based on total employment figures or that are key occupations that others are based on. And you can see here that the nursing-related occupations, including home health aide and nursing assistants, is really the foundation of the overall workforce here in Minnesota. And then looking at some other occupations, there are some of the largest occupations as well. There's really a mix that's needed in our workforce to support the health and mental health care of Minnesotans. And many of these are really key, such as dental hygienists and assistants who can't work without a dentist, pharmacy technicians that are reliant on the pharmacist, the EMTs and paramedics, other healthcare occupations, and the psychologist. And I'll be digging a little more into these occupations as we go. And now we're looking at the job vacancy survey. This is something that DEES does 2 times a year. And these are healthcare occupations with the higher percent of openings. And statewide, the percent of openings per occupation is 3.6%. So these are higher than the overall occupation percentage of openings. And these may not always be a high number of openings, but if the percent is high, it can start to cause some challenges. And again, these openings are either replacement or new openings. And you'll see some of the same occupations we've talked about. The nurses, again, are on here. Also, you can see the highest percent is with the psychiatrists at 18% of all openings, which is a bit striking. And then to focus just a little bit more on the nurses, again, they're really a foundation, and they have a variety of different education levels that are required. The registered nurses, kind of the standard level of education now is a bachelor's degree. A nursing assistant, it's a college certificate, and home health aides, not even having a high school degree, allows them to work. And again, these occupations are still continuing to grow. DEE does a list of occupations with the most openings through 2024, either through growth or replacement. And the registered nurses, home health aides, and nursing assistants are all on that list of occupations as well. And now I'll talk a little bit about the supply of the different occupations. And this slide presents the education pipeline for nurses. So Minnesota is creating a number of nurses each year, a variety of levels, and there are, even for registered nurses, a variety of degrees being offered that can help with laddering as they move up to different levels of nursing. Another important supply indicator is Minnesota residency slots. And you can see here that overall the residency slots have been increasing over time. Looking at the primary care residencies, you'll see in 2004 it was higher, although only 88% of those slots were filled. It dipped a bit, and we've been trying to catch up again, but again, they've been increasing over time, and again, we're still a little lower than the number of slots that were available in 2004. Looking at the psychiatry residencies, we have a small number of slots, but those have been had a few increases early in 2012 and 2013, and then have been holding steady. And all other residencies have been increasing over time. And you can see there at the bottom row, the percent of primary care positions filled has also been very high, especially in the last couple of years. And then of note with the 2016 primary care residencies, another program you've heard about, the International Medical Graduate Program, there's a pediatric spot that's accounted for, and there were actually 2 pediatric residents that were part of that program, so those are included in those numbers. And one other supply indicator is the actively licensed professionals. And our offices works closely with the state boards in Minnesota, and we track the number of different licensed professionals in partnership with them. And then our office additionally does surveys with these licensed professionals to better understand them. And here's a few key occupations. And with licensed professionals, the number licensed is always going to be higher than the number employed. There's a number of different reasons for that. You know, there's people who are retired that keep their license. They may be working out of state, either very close to Minnesota or anywhere in the nation. Some are also just doing a job that doesn't require their license currently, or they're just temporarily not working. So there are people who have licenses that may be interested in working again here within the state. So they are a pool of possible professionals, and many times they hold their license for that reason, that they may want to work again. But you can see, again, the nurses have the highest number. We divide up the physicians to primary care and non-primary care. You can also see dentists and physician's assistants. So and that's a pretty big mix of workforce we can draw on. Another key thing to talk about with the workforce is the aging population. Some people call that the silver tsunami. That it is going to be something we all need to plan for with all these different occupations. And first I'll talk about the primary care workforce. And we have here the primary care physicians, the physician assistants, and the APRNs. And the APRNs and primary care physicians do take a while to finish their degrees, so they are older than the physician assistants. And the physicians really are the oldest of the group. But you can still see here in this slide that there is a somewhat even distribution between the 35 to 44, 45 to 54. So as people retire, there are people in the pipeline that can continue to do the work. Again, it will be important to plan for these retirements coming, but there's other people that are available. And especially the physician assistants are a much younger group to draw from. Looking at the high-level mental health occupations of psychologists and psychiatrists, there is a much different picture. And looking at the psychologists is something new to our office, so when we partnered that with the psychiatrist data, it was quite striking to see how many of the people working in these fields are 55 and older, and then there are many less people in the pipeline to replace these professionals. While there are a variety of mental health workers in other different occupations who are a bit younger, they can't fulfill all of the roles of these especially highly educated professionals, so this is an important thing to watch. And then some other key workforce data. So like I mentioned, our office does surveys with these professionals, and one thing we're starting to track is the people who are doing some kind of preceptorship or training, and here's some initial results from the physicians. And so you can see here that while they are doing some training with professionals to get them into the pipeline, there still is more room for them to do some more of that. Looking at who is educated in Minnesota, who are the licensed professionals, is also important. It does vary by profession. So at LPNs, 93% of those who are licensed, they got their degree in Minnesota. So the education institutions in Minnesota are especially important for those professions. RNs and social workers, the numbers are also high, but there are people who went to school somewhere else, either moving away to go to school and returning, or just coming to Minnesota after their education. So understanding their mix is also important. And then physicians, and this is where they went to school, not the residency like I talked about before, but they have a much lower percent that were educated and went to school here in Minnesota. So that is more a national draw from the schools. And one other thing of note, the nursing board closely tracks the number of APRNs, and they've had a number of changes, especially related to be able to work independently as a scope of practice change. And as of that change, there's been a 15% increase between quarter 1, 2015 and quarter 2, 2016. So that legislation did allow for people to have more interest in this occupation. thing our office focuses on is rural areas of the state, understanding the mix of professionals and where they're located. And we do this by looking at a population to provider ratio. And actually, lower is better on these different graphs, which is a little bit different than when you're looking at most graphs. So the high bars mean there are less professionals compared to the population. And there really is a different mix by the different types of professions. So if you look at the APRN and primary care physicians, you can see that the highest population to provider ratio is in the rural or isolated areas. In the other areas of the state, the population to provider ratio is lower, and it is lowest in the urban areas. If you look at the LPNs and RNs, the mix is quite different than that. You can even see for the LPNs that the highest ratio is in the urban areas, and they are much more representative out in the more rural areas of the state. So on top of the nurses just being the general foundation, in the rural areas, they are even much more the foundation, and people have less access, especially in the rural or isolated areas, to APRNs and primary care physicians. And then looking at emerging professions, I know that's been something your commission has been interested in, and we're starting to be able to track how many people are working in these roles. And these roles are new to fill gaps and support some of the system changes that are happening in healthcare. And for the dental therapists and the doulas, we do have more of a firm cut with those. The dental therapists are licensed by the Board of Dentistry, and they are starting to increase. The numbers are still small, but over time they are going up. The doulas, there are 55 on the Minnesota Department of Health Registry. On the registry, that means they are able to go for Medicaid. There are more practicing that are not on that list, but we felt this was an important number to look at. And then you can see for some of these other occupations, there are quite a few, especially the community health workers. There's almost 1,000 of those. And so looking at all this data, there are a few trends that jump out to really focus on. One is the continued job growth, especially in nursing occupations. That will not change based on projections. It will be important to think about investing in attracting educated workforce, the education programs in Minnesota, and thinking about nationwide, making sure people will come here and work, and also thinking about the career ladder, those types of things. The rural areas, like I mentioned, they really do have a different occupation distribution, and thinking about how to make sure they have what they need to support people in those areas. And then some of these new and innovative solutions, such as emerging occupations and the scope of practice changes, we're seeing some helpful signs from those. And then again, aging, that's something that will be important over the next few years for a variety of occupations. We're seeing some positive signs with the primary health care occupations. It's not as dire as some others. And then the takeaways are a bit harder to say based on what's happening in the healthcare world today. So, you know, as we all know, it's a time of great change. There's a lot of team care, ACOs, payments based on outcomes. So really trying to see how all that plays out and what that means, especially for primary care physicians, is a little bit challenging. So based on all of this, it does seem like there's going to be more team care, where non-physician roles are even more important than what we've even talked about here. There's a variety of places in Minnesota where they're already doing some of that, and they're really learning about what they're doing, but it isn't really set. And then there's other places where they are not taking on these new ways of caring for people. Again, early signs with primary care physicians, things look a little better, but again, we're not sure how everything will play out. And the nursing workforce will continue to be very important, and so continued attention is needed for that. And then we saw with the mental health slide that was one of the most striking things in terms of having more people retiring and older, and so
Thank you, Ms. McLean. Really interesting data. I have a quick question for you. Back to the beginning, the pyramid slide that you showed us, the makeup. I'm just curious, I guess a two-part question. One, how does this pyramid makeup compare to other states? And, you know, according to the department, is this kind of the ratio of proportions we want to see? Or in terms of how this pyramid's built, the order it comes in, things of that nature, or are there things that are a little, we would like to see adjusted because they're not ideal in terms of the makeup?
Madam Chair, so I'm not sure how it compares to all other states. I think it's probably not that different, but I would have to check and get back to you with that. And this really is just the numbers as they currently exist. I think that's more looking at some of the other data. It does seem, for example, the rural makeup, like maybe there aren't people in the right places. That might be more of an issue, those types of things. And that as people retire, we need to make sure we're replacing people. But again, it is a little hard at this point to say exactly if there's a shortage in any particular occupation. And I know you looked at a few years ago some of the studies that were looking at where there might be shortages or not shortages. So I think we're somewhat in the middle in some of those things. So, yeah.
Members, other questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 12, page 4, and you have the bar graph there showing that the age of the primary care workforce. Are you concerned about the few that are 34 and younger of primary care physicians? And should we note that and work to see what we can do to increase the number of students going into primary care?
Ms. McLean.
Madam Chair, well, some of the reason why there are fewer who are 34 and younger is because it does take quite a while to educate a primary care physician. So there are going to be less in that group, but I do think that is an area of concern, and part of why your commission exists is that primary care does need a little more attention to make sure there are the right number of people in that profession and continuing to choose that profession. I think there's a number of studies that say people are choosing that less than some other medical professions, and I think you can see that even in the residency slide, that the residency numbers for other professions are increasing steadily at higher rates, and the number for primary care, while it's increasing, there just aren't as many. It still hasn't gone up to the level where it was in 2004. So that's part of also making sure people can get trained to do that. Even if people want to choose it, there may not always be enough slots to make sure they're trained. So those are the two different things that go together with that.
Representative Kiffmeyer, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay, thank you very much. And so when I look at a couple of these slides, having been on the commission for a while, it seems as though, like in primary care, we're making progress, but it's a long-term process. So when you add two or three slots every year, they take 8 years to finish and get through it all, get established and do that. So it is a long-term. But I think what it says is that continued attention. One of the questions I have is, in sometimes the rural, or especially in this deeper rural mix, it's always a balance between having the providers there, but when it comes to open heart surgeries, when it comes to larger types of cases, hips, knees, things like that, the standard practice is say go where they do a lot of them, because that is a better statistical result in general. But that in the deeper world, what you really want to have is whether it's APRNs, RNs, or others, that blood pressure, diabetes follow through, many of the mental health therapists, a lot of those things are well done, not necessarily needing a primary care physician or an orthopedic surgeon to do that. So can you respond to the balance in regards to the that kind of rural? Do you see that as, because I see it as kind of encouraging. It looks like it's a fairly low across the board in many cases.
Ms. McLean. Madam Chair. Well, I think one thing that's especially important with rural is making sure people can access care and get to the places they need easily. That's one thing our office focuses on, and also responding to emergencies, those types of things. But I think it is more challenging for people in rural areas if they do have a very serious condition. It does become more of a burden on them if they do have to travel to different cities to get this care. So I understand an expert in where they should be, but I do know thinking about the people who live in rural areas and that they can access care easily and cheaply in a timely way is a key thing to also think about. But I can look at some other studies and bring some information back to you about how best to have the mix of specialties in rural areas.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, not seeing any other questions at this point. Thank you, Ms. McLean, so much for the information and data. It's very, very helpful for the discussion. Next we're going to hear from the Department of Human Services an update on the 2016 Direct Care Workforce Summit. Presenters in the department, is that correct, Mr. Bowman?
Madam Chair, no, I think there's one from the department, but there is another presenter on the same topic.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself, and members should have the packet of all the slides. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the task force. I'm Lauren Coleman. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Older Adult Services at the Department of Human Services. And I'm happy to be here. Although I currently focus on services for older Minnesotans, this topic is really relevant to not only older Minnesotans, but people with disabilities, and so I represent that group also. Although the impact of the workforce issues of direct care for workers is a challenge for our entire system, I want to note that it's impacting people today. It's not something that is only going to impact us in the future. It's a challenge that has emerged over the last number of months, if not a couple of years. We're in the early stages of developing recommendations, so if you're expecting the answer today, I'm not going to be able to deliver that solution at this point in time, but we're going to get there. I'm borrowing a few slides from the state demographer to try to set the stage for what our challenge is. And this is the slide that's representing older Minnesotans, and I might note that we would be able to have developed this slide 60 years ago. We knew this was going to be the trend back in the 50s and 60s. It wasn't something that emerged unknown. And we tend to process things based upon our past experiences, and so this has been the trend line for aging in Minnesota. And what it would look like if we continue that same trend. But look what's happening from 2010 to 2030, a large uptick from the boomers. Then it kind of flattens out, but it's really important to note that we're going from 806,000 older Minnesotans in 2015 to roughly 1.3 million in 2030, 15 short years. And it sets the context for what I'm talking about today, the workforce to care for older adults and people with disabilities. So that was kind of the demand side, looking at how many people are going to need services. This is trying to show the supply side. I'll also note that this is not a problem challenge unique to Minnesota. This is a national challenge, and many states, in fact, the national government is trying to devote some resources to find out how we're going to meet the demand. The overall labor force growth has slowed dramatically since 2010, and as you can see in 2020, that decade, it's going to slow even more so. The job vacancy rate, according to Dee, is going to continue to escalate, and particularly in greater Minnesota, where we're going to have even larger challenges. I also will note from D, 22% of all job vacancies statewide are accounted for by your topic, the healthcare and social assistance sector. Another slide that shows the demand. Direct care workers are an economic force to try to meet the demands of this growing population. We currently employ about 135,000 people in Minnesota providing direct care and support services. We project over the next number of years we will need 60,000 more direct care workers to meet the growing demands of an aging population. So, as more people will need services, we are approaching this from the standpoint that this is not a challenge that government can meet alone. It's a challenge that government, along with providers, advocates, consumers, will need to work together to address over the next number of years. This challenge is not going to go away. Some more data. Again, by 2030, one in five Minnesotans will be over the age of 65, and that is what is driving a lot of employment projections. Home healthcare industry is already at the top of the projected growth need over the next 10-year period. I have to make this statement, although it puts me in an awkward position, but I just have to make it. The one thing that would ease some of this recruitment and retention is wages. The wages in these job categories are not, on average, sustainable to a living wage for a family of three. The living wage is about $16.34 by our calculations, and that's quite a bit different from the categories you see on this graph. Job quality also matters. We've seen an increasing use of part-time workers by various employers, and that challenges families and households to make ends meet when they're not able to get the number of hours or have the job quality that helps them stay in the industry. It's a seller's market from a labor standpoint. We see evidence of this in our everyday lives. If you go to Lund Firelease, they've got right printed on every receipt. Sign up right now. We're having a job fair on Saturday, wherever. If you go to Burger King, Starbucks, Menards, everybody is competing for workers in today's economy. So, the summit was our attempt to bring together a diverse group of stakeholders. And it's the first time in a long, long time that we've had everybody in the same room to talk about a common challenge. Our goal was not to focus on a particular service, such as PCA, or specific locations or specific populations. We were looking for strategies that cut across populations, across types of services and supports and settings. We also weren't talking exclusively about what the Department of Human Services should do, or what the governor should do, or what the legislature should do. We were trying to keep it, let's bring forth all ideas and work on this together. We were looking for creativity and identifying the next steps rather than the department deciding what the process was going to look like and here's how we're going to work on this. We're trying to harness the creativity and the energy among a diverse group of stakeholders. We expected solutions to emerge about compensation, recruitment, retention, technology, quality, credentialing, career ladders, and more. So the summit was the start of that conversation that will be ongoing. I want to acknowledge and thank. We had over 30 organizations co-sponsor the summit. Provider organizations, other parts of government, consumers, participants, advocates. They all participated in planning the summit, and they're all going to have a role in determining next steps. We had almost 200 people attend. We also had workers, direct care workers. We had consumers, program participants. So we had a broader view of what does the impact of the worker shortage look like and what are some of the solutions. They brought forward over 300 solutions. Some themes emerged, though. And so we've tried to capture those in kind of five buckets. As I mentioned before, increased workers' wages and benefits. That was probably the most common refrain from just about every work group as part of the day. How to expand the worker pool. I've already mentioned we're going to need 60,000 additional. And that's assuming we can retain the 135,000 that are already in the system. Enhanced direct care support and training, looking at employee engagement, job satisfaction, how do we elevate the status of this challenging work, and how do we consider a public awareness campaign so we can get more people to consider this as a priority. We're also administering opinion surveys to direct care workers. We want their views as well as people receiving services. Those are being assembled now and put together in a report. We'll be convening with the same stakeholder advisory group at the end of this month to talk about next steps. How do we organize the next phase of work? Do we organize it around populations? Do we organize it around settings? Again, we don't want to decide for the direct care workers, the providers, the consumers. We'd like it to emerge from how they would like to move forward. And we're viewing ourselves as more of the convener. More of the, we will collect the information, we will report out to to groups like yours and consider steps that we can take as part of government, steps that providers can take, et cetera. It was a great day, full of ideas, enthusiasm, and we're going to try to maintain that momentum when we meet at the end of this month to determine next steps. Madam Chair and committee members, that's my presentation today. It's answering questions.
Thank you. Senator Kinkmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Coleman, the question I have for you is, on our age categories, you know, working and addressing the additional pool, you know, expanding the workforce thing, are you including a look, because I know you don't have any results yet, but are you including a look at 15 to 18-year-olds, and the reason why is I remember in my younger years working as a dietary aide at a nursing home and working in housekeeping and other things. It exposes you to the professions
gives you an opportunity to learn working employment skills, a variety of things. It was a great experience. And so I'm just wondering if, because I think some of our labor laws have gone to the point of some of the restrictive hours, some other things, but are you just including that at least as something to look at?
Manager, Senator, there were recommendations around similar strategies that you've perhaps seen in other sectors about how do we get to high school age people as they're selecting their career paths, as they're developing experience in the workforce, talking to counselors and making presentations. So yes, that is part of the recommendation. We're also looking at populations that previously have not been considered part of the solution. We're looking at older individuals themselves and how they can be part of a solution to support people in need of service. We're looking at people with disabilities and how jobs for that untapped sector could perhaps be part of the solution.
Very good. I think that's encouraging. Mm-hmm. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Coleman, I'm wondering with the workers' summit here, the conversations between what the consumers wanted and what the providers had, if they were on the same page, if the wants of the consumer are different than the wants of the workers, and where they see that going. Because what I hear a little bit is that the consumers want something a little bit different than what the providers are willing or able to provide in the future.
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think the desires are substantially different. I think the ability to deliver and match up the desires of the consumers by the providers is a challenge. But I don't think there was a lot of disagreement about what we would like to see or what the consumers would like to see, which is primarily dependability, consistency, a direct care person or support person that they know so that they receive the supports in a manner that is personalized to that individual. And I think the providers would like to be able to schedule and deliver that type of consistent service, but the workforce challenges don't always allow it. But there's more in common than there is in difference.
Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. I think that that brought up a very good discussion about things that I hear from my district about those who are receiving services. And it kind of reminds me of kind of what's going on right now in the cable services industry. You pay for a monthly package, and whether you want it or don't want it, if you want to get this one program, you got to buy this fast. And so you pay for all of them. And so sometimes what I hear them say, this is from the disability community as well as from seniors, they feel bad sometimes that there is a payment for a basket of services when what they want is this one part of it. And I think that drives up costs. That drives the costs overall. And so I think that line of questioning from Representative Schumacher is very important to have a consideration for the consumers. And if I hear them ask before, I don't want to get a basket. I want to say that this is my particular need and this is what I would like to have, and I don't want to be paying for all these other things. So I know you're at a spot where you are working on some of those things, so I think it's a crucial time where we can maybe help give input. I'm not expecting you to have any solutions or answers today, but I do want to have that those consumers, that idea or that concept is maybe introduced into that next meeting's conversation, if you would.
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Senator, duly noted.
Any other questions or comments, members? Okay, thank you, Mr. Coleman. We really appreciate it. And then I understand we have someone here from the Minnesota Healthcare Association to testify. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. And my understanding is members also have
have slides in their packet.
Thank you.
If you could just introduce yourself,
yes,
and then when you're ready, proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Judy Beal, and I am here representing the Minnesota Home Care Association today as chair of our newly created workforce task force. I'm going to play with technology here now. So, Minnesota Home Care Association represents approximately 170 home care providers, ranging from those who are Medicare certified and provide skilled nursing visits to those who may have provide basic services, comprehensive licensed services, and personal care assistance. We've been in business for nearly 50 years, and we've been the premier home care association in Minnesota. Our goal is to work to increase access for consumers to high-quality home care services, payment reform, workforce solutions, and more.
We're on the homepage.
I'm sorry. This year we formed a workforce task force that is comprised of both providers, home care providers, and academic institutions to address the workforce shortage. Our areas of focus, after extensive brainstorming, we boiled down to increase student awareness of health care positions in home health care. So we're looking at both pre-enrollment and healthcare programs, such as the Scrubs Camp, sponsored by the Health Force Minnesota. And we're also looking at increasing their understanding of home health as an alternative to hospital care while they're in their healthcare program. Secondly, we're looking at enhancing industry and academic partnership along the lines of the Pipeline Project. I believe you're all familiar with that project. Currently, there have been a couple of new categories of workers that have been designed and with training competencies, competency-based training for both that application as well as healthcare. Competency. It's been wonderfully successful, and we're hoping to expand on that. And third, we're focusing on clinical sites and simulation experience. I believe you heard earlier on recent information coming out of the National State Boards of Nursing regarding simulation experience as a possible enhancement to clinical site training. I believe the Minnesota Board of Nursing will be discussing this and rules surrounding that later this week. Some of the issues that you've probably heard from many people are that there is a high demand for service, and it's growing. Nursing and PCA staffing issues seem to be the most critical and most extreme. The acuity of patients, the level of complexity that are being discharged from hospitals, is increasing dramatically. And agencies are currently turning down referrals because they are unable to staff.
Why?
There are some recruitment challenges. So reimbursement for hospital and now long-term care facilities has undergone dramatic change. While payment reform for home and community-based services needs to be reviewed and some recommendations changed. Metro Home Health Care are currently, some of our home care agencies are seeing applicants from striking nurses. I know you've probably been involved in reading the press. The big issue is over benefits and health care benefits and payment for that. But nurses working in hospitals are paid somewhere in the vicinity of $40 to $45 an hour. Nurses working in long-term care facilities are currently paid somewhere in the $30 to $33 per hour. And nurses in home care settings are paid on average $27 an hour. For LPNs, it's $24 and $10 to $12 for PCA services. So agencies employing PCAs or home health aides are competing with retail and fast food restaurants due to higher starting wages. And home care agencies needing nurses are competing with hospitals and long-term care facilities to hire staff. We also have some retention challenges, and that is the inequities in wage and benefits. Obviously, we work to provide benefits to our home health care workers. However, to try and match some of those that have been at least cited by the striking nurses and Minnesota Nurse Association are pretty dramatically different and much richer benefits than we're able to afford to offer. The employees in home health segments have to work alone in an environment over which they have very little control because it's in the subscriber, the recipient's home. They don't have that peer-to-peer relationship that nurses in long-term care facilities or hospitals or PCAs might be able to have if they work in retail or fast food because they're the lone soldier out there. The healthcare worker also needs additional training specific to not only their organization, but to the very specific needs of the clients that they're serving. And as you heard earlier from Assistant Commissioner Coleman, dependability is a very important aspect of the clients receiving care. And so they like to have one worker assigned, and then they have that consistency, that dependability, that reliability. Only healthcare professionals looking to work in the home care field are looking for a diversity of experience. They're looking not just for one experience, but they would like to grow their practice in the nursing field or in the aid field. And the inability to staff adequately causes additional burnout in existing staff. The reimbursement challenges are typically in the home health industry, either the payment is on an hourly basis or on a per visit basis. So it sounds like, well, reimbursement rates on an hourly basis should be high enough to cover not only the wages and the benefits of the workers, but they also have to cover orientation, training, agency rent, licensure, regulatory satisfaction, liability, insurance, outcome measurement and reporting, vehicles and gas. They have to get the workers to the recipients of care. And then they pay rent and have support staff also. The consequences if the issues remain unresolved are that home care agencies just are not able to admit new patients without adequate staff, and therefore those hospital discharges are delayed. Clients go home with inadequate resources, and that could result in higher readmission rates or negative health care outcomes to the client. And patients' access to services is limited or very restricted. Independent living is limited. Metro area is problematic in terms of resource scarcity, and the rural area is actually in crisis. Our recommendations are to address the reimbursement deficit in home and community-based services, to create innovative funding for training and competency-based certification for workers in home and community-based services, and new grad nursing programs in home care. And then finally, to develop incentives for additional academic and industry partnerships in creating sim labs, simulation scenarios for those workers. We heard recently from a PCA recipient who disagrees that additional training should be provided for PCAs. And while I understand and completely support that recipient because he feels that there's already such a shortage of workers, that to add additional training burden would even further compromise availability of PCAs. However, we believe that in partnership and perhaps on a basis similar to the pipeline where we're doing on-the-job training support in terms of competency-based specific to the client's needs may enhance that versus detract from that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Members, any questions or comments?
Yeah.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, if there's been any discussion on service alternatives that we can perform, how do you structure it? When you have people out in the community, PCAs, you've got one-to-one. Have you looked at any alternatives to try to change how that service is being provided?
Ms. Teal. Thank you, Representative Mack. Senator Clausen, what we're looking at is use of some of the technology. I think you'll hear a report and an update on telehealth and related to, I think it depends on the segment of the industry. You've certainly been meeting, as I have, about robots and increasing some mechanical functions or technology available for these in-home recipients of care to be supported so that they won't necessarily need to have that 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week provider, if you will. So that kind of looks at that from one angle. However, a lot of testing, a lot of data needs to be done in order to support that can be done safely.
Members, any other questions or comments? Thank you, Ms. Gill.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being here. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just point out to members one public comment that the commission received last night that was copied in and in your packet from a consumer on this topic. It's kind of an excerpt from an email. Unfortunately, it looks like the sender's full name didn't copy, but we can get that to you. In blue ink, public comments from Minnesota PCA recipient impacted by workforce shortage. Just an FYI, call that to your attention. I also just noticed that the sender referred to some linked documents, which we don't have in front of us, but we can get those to you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum. Ms. Gill.
And that was the feedback. I received that email as well, and so that was the gentleman that I was speaking about in terms of my testimony.
Thank you for that clarification. Okay, members, we're going to go to our next agenda item, the mental health workforce update. And we have Valerie DeBoer here, as well as Lynn Fando. So welcome to the committee. You could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the commission. My name is Valerie DeBoer, and I'm the executive director of Health Force Minnesota. Health Force is one of eight centers of excellence in the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. We are proud to be hosted by Winona State University and to work with our many partners. To identify and address healthcare workforce issues, needs, and challenges across Minnesota. Today, I'm pleased to share with you an update of the Mental Health Workforce Development Plan that was submitted to the legislature in January 2015. You do have a copy of the executive summary of the plan, along with a progress report that highlights some of the key outcomes to date. The Mental Health Workforce Development Plan was crafted by a large steering committee made up of experts in the field. Members represented mental health professionals, state agencies, licensure boards, associations, public and private educational institutions, advocacy groups, providers, and legislators. Senator Clausen, we continue to be grateful for your participation on that steering committee. After 15 15 months of regional meetings, forums, surveys, steering committee meetings, and a day-long summit attended by 150 people, a mental health development plan with 24 consensus-based recommendations was submitted to the legislature in January of 2015. And I'm happy to say that as of right now, at least 10 of those 24 recommendations have been implemented in whole or in part. The 24 recommendations were broken into five categories: recruitment, education planning, placement after program completion, retention, and assessment. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to highlight a few of the recommendations. The complete, all of the recommendations are included in the presentation, and we have those on the PowerPoint. But I'm going to skip through the slide. Recommendation one focused on pipeline development, which is along the lines of Senator Kiffmeyer's question to Assistant Commissioner Coleman. This recommendation called upon organizations within the state to expose middle and high school students to mental health careers. And I'm happy to say that my organization, Health Force Minnesota, incorporated mental health sessions at each of our 16 STARS camps held this past summer. Recommendation four focused on the availability of mental health professionals to provide the requisite hours of supervision for newly graduated mental health professionals. Progress on this recommendation has included a good discussion among the mental health professional licensing boards about common areas of interest that could possibly result in expanding the availability of supervisors. The Board of Social Work approved an emeritus license that allows retired social workers to provide supervisory hours. More work does remain to fully implement, does remain to be done to fully implement this recommendation. Recommendation six focused on geographic accessibility of mental health professional education programs. And I'm sharing this recommendation because it really illustrates the spirit of collaboration and partnership that was very evident in the creation of the Mental Health Workforce Plan. The committee referred to in Recommendation 6 has met numerous times, four times over the last year, to identify needs, barriers, and solutions to ensuring that our rural residents of Minnesota have access to mental health professional education programs. Also related to Recommendation 6, the Winona State University School of Nursing is starting a new postgraduate certificate program for nurse practitioners who wish to become psychiatric and mental health nurse practitioners. This program will be predominantly online, with students completing clinical hours in their home location. So really amenable to folks attending and participating in this program from across the state of Minnesota. The WSU program expects to begin in the summer of 2017 with 12 students. And we're going to be working very closely with healthcare employers as the program is being developed. And it's also reaching out to and sharing with the two other psychiatric nurse practitioner programs that we have in our state, those being at the University of Minnesota and the College of Nebraska. Recommendation 7 calls for increasing the number of psychiatric residency slots in Minnesota. And legislation was enacted in 2015, which resulted in funding for two additional psychiatric residency slots. And I didn't want to just show all of the great outcomes. I did want to be kind of balanced in the presentation. But Recommendation 14 is shown as having no progress to date. This recommendation focused on increasing exposure to psychiatric and mental health experiences for nursing and medical school students, including increasing continuing education offering in those areas. And so while no official activity has really been identified, I know that many healthcare faculty have participated in various meetings and forums related to the plan, and that they are taking this information and understand this need and are incorporating mental health experiences into curriculum. It's just not being done kind of as a formal project as part of the plan. Recommendation 18 is another success story made possible by legislative support. The Minnesota Loan Forgiveness is another success story made possible by legislative support. The Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program was expanded by $5.2 million over the biennium, and mental health professionals were added to the program. Over 40 individuals have received loan forgiveness through the expansion of this loan forgiveness program, which is administered by the Office of Rural Health and Friendliness here. I also share with the commission, the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care reported that one mental health professional who had applied for loan forgiveness actually expanded and added a new location to her practice, and that location is in an underserved area of the Twin Cities. So that's exactly the kind of outcome that the loan forgiveness programs were designed to achieve for us. We did include in our recommendations, our recommendation 24, the very final recommendation, and that was that we continue to assess the progress made on the recommendations, tracking not only were they implemented, but did they actually achieve the goal. And so I'm happy to say that that work is continuing. The members of our steering committee have continued to meet, even though really that the committee has discharged its responsibility with the submission of the plan. That committee last met at the end of June. They will be pulling the committee back together again this fall. And what that allows us to do is to capture the impact and the outcomes of the plan, but then to also figure out what else needs to happen and how do we ensure that other recommendations that aren't yet implemented reach fruition. This slide was really designed to be more like a stoplight, a dashboard, just to show you. Greens mean great progress has been made on recommendations. Yellow means some progress has been made. And then the red recommendations, probably it's fair to say they need to still be shepherded and implemented. But clearly, significant progress has been made, and we thank you for your support in advancing some of the recommendations and in your interest in this topic. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for being here, members. Any questions? Senator Kinsmeyer.
Thank you. The question I have for you is on a scope of practice. So when I take a look at, and having worked on some of these areas for a while, you always want to make sure you maximize your skills and knowledge and experience of those professionals already functioning. So we had some HRM work on that. I was kind of looking to see, I think, physician's assistants also in the area of mental health. I see encouraging signs in a lot of this in here that some of the things that have been initiated are, it takes a while for that to kind of produce its effect, but they are ongoing year after year. But I couldn't find the physician assistant in particular, but I know that was newer legislation, so maybe it's not reflected yet. Would you just give me a verbal little update on that?
Ms. DePaul.
Madam Chair, Senator Kinsmeyer. Scope of practice did not come forward with any intensity in the steering committee or in the layout of the meetings related to the plan. With regard to physician assistance, it might be a better question for the Minnesota, she's been following me, but My understanding of that is there was some, I think, discussion at the legislature about the education and training and competencies related to mental health care provision and how that fits within the physician assistant program. So I might just need to leave it at that. I can certainly take your thoughts and questions back to our next steering committee meeting as well and forward you any outcomes of that discussion.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members, comments? Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just before, I haven't worked with you for the last 4 years. I really appreciate the work you've done and work of the committee members as we move ahead on this issue. One of the things we've talked about is the shortage of faculty and members who teach in our colleges and universities. And you talked about the online degree program. Just earlier, Ms. McClain, in her presentation, she talked a little bit about the shortage of clinical sites. And I'm just wondering, as you look at expanding this program online in rural areas of Minnesota, maybe some comments on those clinical hours. What do you see as the future of that being a viable process?
Ms. DeFord. Madam Chair, Senator Clausen. With the specificity on the Winona State new post-grad certification program for mental health nurse practitioners, the faculty who are developing that program immediately reached out to mental health providers and employers to gauge and understand their capacity to serve as clinical sites for those students. And they have been met with great enthusiasm from the employers that they've reached out to. So I think they feel quite comfortable in being able to handle clinical site placements for this particular program. The online component of it is one aspect that I think makes the burden of providing clinical spots allows it to be dispersed across the state because students might be enrolled in the program from Marshall, but they would facilitate getting a clinical spot there in their hometown instead of everybody coming to Rochester to the Winona State campus in Rochester and having to find their clinical spot within that geography. So I think for that particular program, the feedback and the availability feels pretty positive. We did hear, Senator Clausen, you were there with us, clinical site availability is a huge challenge, especially in certain aspects of the healthcare occupational education program. What we are also excited about, though, with the Winona State program, because I know the University of Minnesota and College St. Scholastica as nurse practitioner programs for on-site MP, they do have challenges finding clinical spots. The Winona State faculty are in communication with both those program directors, and to the extent we uncover new clinical opportunities, those will be shared with those two existing programs. So we hope that we're sort of all boats are kind of rising with the availability of more sites. But then I just want to take this chance to say that clinical site availability in other occupations is a great concern, I think, for our education program. I know our nurse practitioner physician assistant programs in the state are very challenged to find clinical spots. I work with our clinical laboratory community. We have had students not graduate on time because they could not get a clinical spot. So that is something that Health Force is working on where we can, and I know a lot of healthcare employers and educators are coming together to try to remove that barrier.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up. Earlier today in the last meeting, we talked about the possibility of virtual reality as part of that clinical training, and it seems like there's some movement there. Could you perhaps comment on what do you think the biggest barrier is to finding those clinical sites?
Ms. DeFore.
Madam Chair, Senator Falcon. Honestly, I think the biggest barrier is just how our healthcare system is run, it is reimbursed,
we're at when you ask someone to take students, whether that's a hospital or a clinic, a large group practice, to a dental office, you're asking professionals who are already probably working in understaffed or very lean. There is not often the capacity just to take on an additional responsibility in that unit for clinical education. I think that's the real issue. If it used to be there was some capacity in our healthcare providers, and more, I think as financially they get more constrained, that's being kind of squeezed out, and it's having this impact now on the education.
I just had a question about in an earlier presentation, they talked about job vacancies in the psychiatrist areas, 18%. But we recognize that there's a difference in the age of professionals in the mental health area, tending to be older. I just wondered if the residency slot recommendation, is that something that would we have students interested in filling additional residency spots if they could be provided? I know that links up with clinical training sites as well, and you know, maybe there's a point where we can't meet that clinical training need as well, but it just seems like wondered if increasing the residency slots in the psychiatric area, if that's a possibility, yeah, what you've done so far.
Ms. DeFore.
Madam Chair, I might need to get back to you with some more specifics about that question. My sense is the way the additional residency program slots were funded was through grants made by the Office of Rural Health and Family Care to providers. And so I believe the providers who applied for those funds had a sense that there were medical students interested and, you know, that they've been turning away those who wanted to become do their residency in psychiatry here in Minnesota. I don't have data or a definitive answer about that.
Okay, thank you so much for taking the time to be here, Ms. DeFore, and we'll hear from our other testifier on this issue, Ms. Sando from NAMI. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, everyone. My name is Lynn Sando, and I'm the Public Policy Coordinator with NAMI Minnesota. We're the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we're an education support and advocacy group for people living with mental illness and their family. And I'm really happy to be here today, and thank you all for being here as well. I really want to echo Assistant Commissioner Coleman's comments about the solutions to these workforce matters. It will really come from a collaborative effort between advocacy groups, providers, from the legislature, from our state department as well. So thank you all for all the work that you've been doing and continue to do. What we're hearing at NAMI Minnesota, we hear from the community, from our NAMI members, and also by Jason Corden, Barry Simmons, our executive director, Steve Everett, working with the Mental Health Workforce Summit, and then I had the pleasure of being at the Director Care Summit just earlier this summer. But what we're hearing, though, is in all areas of the mental health workforce, we're experiencing challenges. So in those high-level professional roles, psychiatry, psychologists, but also in the community, PCAs, ARMS workers, ILFs, those whole community-based services, which are really equally important when we're looking at a continuum of care and an integrated healthcare system. So it's really important that we focus on those high-level professionals, but also from a preventative standpoint, we know that a lot of the people that we represent, they spend a majority of the time in the community, and that's where we want to be able to serve them as well. From my own experience, so coming to you here as a policy person now, I actually started in the mental health field as a PCA worker. I also did ILS work, and I was a mental health targeted case manager before coming into policy. And really, I experienced a lot of the things that other presenters here were talking about as far as livable wages, being able to find people who can provide supervision for my license. I was about a little over a year shy of getting dual licensure before I decided, you know what, there needs to be something done, and I want to go back and see from a policy standpoint where we can find better ways and innovative ideas in how to get our mental health workforce professionals through all that schooling that we need, all that licensing, the tests, all those things, and make sure that they're well supported and that well educated, and really build up our workforce in the mental health field and the healthcare field in general. Two points I kind of wanted to touch on right now. Our executive director, Sue Everett Holden, would really like to be here today. She's actually completing a 40-city tour for NAMI Minnesota's 40th anniversary, so she's on her way to Cambridge. But she wrote me an email yesterday, and she wanted to let me know that in coming here, she's been hearing from people in the community, all over Minnesota, Greater Minnesota, here in the Twin Cities as well, that we're not there fully implementing what we've found out in the recommendations from the Workforce Summit. But everywhere that she's going, people are talking about how there's just not enough providers out there. So psychiatrists people to, prescribe medications at higher level of care, but also that home-based service care as well. Another thing we've been hearing also from the Mental Health Legislative Network, which makes up about 30 health organizations, advocacy organizations, we've been hearing that a lot of psychiatrists in community mental health centers, they're receiving lower reimbursement rates for Medicaid and MA. And so it's making it really difficult for our community mental health centers to recruit and retain those psychiatrists that are really needed in those community settings. So with that, I'm more than happy to take questions. I guess I wanted to touch on Senator Kipnire's question as well. I don't have anything specific. I would be more than happy to get back about physician assistance. But one thing I will say is that we're really looking to implement mental health curriculum, de-escalation training into a number of fields where professionals are meeting with people in the community who are experiencing mental health crisis, who live with mental illnesses. So our first responders, we get a lot of work in implementing training for teachers, seeing our young people experiencing maybe their first episode of psychosis or experiencing symptoms of mental illness within a school setting, but also in the medical field. So I'm more than happy to get back specifically about physician assistance, but we're really looking to make sure that anyone in the community, our professionals, our providers, people who are meeting with people who are experiencing symptoms of mental illnesses and their families, they have that adequate training. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sando. Members, any questions or comments? Senator Pittman.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate, Ms. Sando, your addressing here the front issue. Probably the bigger philosophy over here, and I think you've touched on a little bit, is to make sure that every qualified person is not restricted in any way. One of the fun things about registered nurses or physicians, that there's a field of medicine from industrial medicine to school medicine to aging population issues to mental health issues. And every single provider, you should kind of will develop along the way kind of a special interest for a variety of reasons. So in the area of mental health, you can't afford to have any professional not being able to have the full scope of practice in every one of those fields to meet that need. So I'll look forward to a little bit more information, but my experience serving in Health and Human Services is that there were some barriers in regards to some of those areas, and so I'm hoping that we're maybe removing those blocks and helping everybody to fully practice in the whole broad categories. Thank you for addressing. I'll look for that information. Thank you.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to comment, I've been receiving updates. You know, about every other week, NAMI's been sending out some really good information. I really appreciate receiving that. I'm sure you send it out to all legislative members, but I think that's good work. It really states the problems that we're facing in our state and also providing some solutions. But just a comment on this workforce. I just was reviewing an update on the state demographics, and it's interesting that every year we have about 37,500 residents leave the state. and relocate to other states. Two-thirds of those are college students. A comparison is Wisconsin has over 50,000 people leaving their state for other states and relocating, but I don't know the college percentage. But that's concerning because we don't know if those young people are ever going to return. And that's our future workforce. And I think something that we need to look at, and the university's been discussing this because the old tuition, out-of-state tuition issue, how high should it be? Because they know they need to fill the gap. If you've got 28,000 students leaving every year, what are you bringing back? And I know they're bringing back only 21,000. So we've got a 7,000 student deficit, and we also have two-thirds of the people relocating to other states are students at colleges. So those are some things we have to address. That's not your issue. It's just a comment. But I think we need to take a better look at how do we preserve our own workforce by keeping people here, and then secondly, how do we recruit others to come to our state? So that's perhaps something that we can be looking at in 2017. Thank you again for your work on behalf
of me. Madam Chair, and
Ms. Bando.
I really appreciate those comments. And as a person who left the state to go to college and then returned for graduate work, I know that Minnesota, we're really fortunate for the fact that we just have the greatest resources. We have the best schools. Mental health is something that is just very present in our state. And so one of the reasons why I came back and something that we should just continue to focus on and foster and build for the community.
Thank you, Ms. Sandel, for being here. We appreciate it. Members, we're going to switch gears to our final agenda item, which is update on telehealth. And we have Dan McKenzie. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Anna McKenzie. I am the Executive Director of the Office of Broadband Development. What I have to say this morning is a little bit different ballpark than what you've been hearing previously, but obviously the invitation signaled that you understand the ties very, very well and the importance of the work that we do and how it relates to the work that you all address here. Because we really see ourselves as the infrastructure builders in supporting a number of the pieces that you talked about today with the telehealth and telemedicine aspects of our healthcare system. And I just threw in, obviously I usually talk about straight broadband, but wanted to put something in there a little bit that helps us make the connections between the issues that you all address. And you've likely seen these numbers because they're from the Department of Health's e-health 2016 e-health report. But it really, to my mind, highlights the fact that the work that the state is doing around making sure that broadband is accessible everywhere is important to healthcare. And that's a full 74% of our rural clinics are using telehealth and telemedicine for some aspects of the work they do. You'll see that the three pieces that are particularly common are chronic disease management, remote patient monitoring, staff medical education, which I heard notes of all three of those from previous speakers. My colleague Maureen Eidecker sits on the broadband task force and is also director of telehealth for within the Essentia system. And she highlighted a study done at the university that found the use of daily home monitoring equipment of blood pressure, scales, oximeters, and video visits directly correlated to a drop by 25 percentage points in the rate of patients requiring higher levels of care, such as ER, hospital, or nursing home levels of care. So there is some work being done out there to take a look at what the benefits are of this work. And I just briefly want to put a personal note on this. My husband is a type 1 diabetic and has been since he was a child. And he has precipitous drops in blood sugar that have led to 2 emergency room visits in the last year. Since that last visit, he now has a new sensor on him that pings me. I'm down here in St. Paul, and he's in our home in Grand Marais when his blood sugar drops to a dangerous level. So we have firsthand knowledge of how valuable these remote monitoring tools can be. Very briefly, I'm not going to read through this slide. Some of you have seen our general presentation about what the broadband of office is up to, have seen this slide, but the state has recognized the importance of broadband connectivity to all of our community anchor institutions, including K-12, as well as healthcare and public safety and government service delivery. And as such, has done a lot of work in the policy and program space in this area. This slide just briefly gives you a little bit of history. The modern history of that work goes back to 2010 when the first broadband task force was put into place to consider what the broadband issues are here in Minnesota, identify the gaps, and propose policy solutions that may address those goals. As part of their work, they recommended that the state set a border-to-border goal of reaching every home and business and institution with at least a moderate level of broadband service. And that first round of goals was set in 2010. In the most recent round of legislation, those goals were reconfirmed and updated and set that by the year 2022, the goal is to see that everyone in the state has access to a level of service that meets the FCC's minimum definition, which is 25 megabits down by 3 megabits up. And there is an auxiliary goal of by 2026, making sure that every home and business has access to at least one provider of 100 meg service, 100 down, 20 up. I hesitate to get too far to the weeds, but those paying attention, those were important numbers that were discussed during the last round of legislation, so I want to make sure we note those goals. One recommendation from the task force that was acted on was the formation of our Office of Broadband Development, which we opened our doors indeed at the beginning of 2014, and that law created our office and tasked us with many things, among them which are monitoring and measuring the broadband access, which I was asked to come here and talk to you today a little bit about. And we also serve as that central resource point for communities, providers, individuals. We get telephone calls every day from our office from individuals in a panic realizing that they don't have the level of connectivity available at their home to support what's happening at school or at work. And again, I won't read this slide. This is more for your reference to have you pass it. These are some of the other things that we do. Quite often, legislators receive calls from constituents and would like some assistance in addressing their questions around broadband. And this is just a reminder that we are out there as a resource for this work. I think this next slide, the map, is was one of the primary reasons that you asked me to come today, is to share with you the progress and what the situation on the ground is regarding where broadband is and is not available in the state. This is the most current 2016 map, and you will see, and it is based on that 2022 goal of 25 down, 3 up, and you will see there are large swaths of the state that have made progress, but as well, the pink areas are the areas that represent the areas that do not reach service at that FCC level of 25.3.
I'm sorry, I could introduce you or interrupt you for just one moment. Senator Kipmeyer has a question related to the map.
Absolutely. Okay. What is the source of your information in regards to the coverage? Is this what I understand is that this is a self-reported from the providers?
Starting in 2010, there was a measuring and monitoring system that was in place that was funded by the federal government. That was called the SBI, and they collected data from every broadband provider in the state. And a component of that was sending out field verifiers to verify that data. I don't think anyone represents that the data is perfect. And you'll see in the full version of this, there are caveats there. We talk to communities all the time about let us know. You are our best eyes on the ground of where this is accurate and where it's not accurate. And we actually will send a field validator out there to confirm what they're telling us about those maps, and we'll get them corrected in those areas.
Senator Kinsman. Thank you, Madam Chair. As I understand, though, there's also, you can send somebody out, I'm sure that expensive cost is, I think there are websites that you can go in and they'll just run, without charge, a test for your specific home on your download and upload speeds. I've done that before myself. Because that's what really matters, is in your home. Do you make that information available as well for citizens to use kind of that situation for themselves rather than sending an employee out to a particular area?
Ms. McKenzie.
Senator? I believe what you're talking about is a speed test,
yes.
And those are available, and we do take a look at the results of those speed tests. One of the barriers that we found in using those speed tests is they have a variety of methods of being performed and can have weaknesses. And so if we are trying to use them to defend a position, we haven't found a strong way to use that data to defend whatever position is trying to take.
Thank you for that clarification. You can proceed.
And so the next map that you're looking at is our county heat map, and it's just the same data that shows you on a percentage basis. Those red counties are the counties that have less than 50% of their homes and businesses have levels of service at that 25.3. But this map has changed over the last 7 years, and progress has been made, but we'll see. From this slide that we still have an estimated 209,000 homes that still don't have access to that level of service. I will note, too, the blue areas are areas where the success stories are happening. And for those, characterizing what's happening in those areas is they are typically a small local provider, either a privately owned provider, a co-op, or sometimes a new entrant that's come in and chosen to make significant investments in long-term infrastructure in those areas. The next slide is just a brief look at where the counties stand in relationship to the 2026 goals. You'll see that some counties are set for that goal, while we have a large number that still have a ways to go in that 109 down, 29 up, which was based, there was a lot of legislative discussion around setting those numbers and based on projections of average household increase of use. And just briefly, one of the policy tools that was put in place, recognizing that this infrastructure was important to have available statewide and ubiquitously, and recognizing that the traditional financial models used to build it in other places doesn't work in our most sparsely and populated areas and the areas with difficult terrain. So one of the policy tools that was recommended by the task force and put in place in 2014 was the border-to-border broadband matching grant program. And we are now in our third year of implementing that program. It's designed to really provide that gap funding piece to find that tipping point where we can incent those providers to come into those areas that are more costly to serve. The next map shows you where the awards have gone over the first two rounds of the program. We were able to award 31 projects across the state in the two rounds. You'll see we were able to achieve good geographic dispersed variety. We are serving over 10,000 homes, businesses, and institutions with that that portfolio of 31 projects. Over $71 million in total investments, over 40 of which came from outside and private and matching investments that are now going to put infrastructure into the rural parts of our states. And the good news is that just yesterday the application window closed for the third round, which was appropriated $35 million in the last session, and we are excited to see enthusiastic interest in the program. While it is too soon to know what we've got in the hopper, our staff is estimating we have about 70
for those funds, and they appear to be coming from all parts of the state. And then just briefly, the next slide is just a shot to remind people what this work actually looks like. This is tough work out in rural parts of the state. That top photo is a young man up in the northwestern part of the state after the heavy rains, up to his chest in mud, putting a final fiber optic connection up in northwestern Minnesota. And the one, the lower one is an demonstration of why Rock County is called Rock County. They ended up encountering rock deposits in plenty of places where they weren't banking on it. I have the honor of traveling to Big Fork Valley Clinic in Balsam, Minnesota on Thursday to celebrate another one of the wins from this program. It's a tiny little clinic that could not adequately participate in electronic health records and the telemedicine tools that we've been hearing about today. And because of this program, they are now connected and able to offer that full gamut of services to their service shed. So from our seat, we get calls every day from the folks that I told you about earlier that are in a panic because they don't have access. The fact that this tool is available for providers to help them say yes to those folks. We are bullish on this incentive program as a policy tool to close this gap.
Thank you, Ms. McKenzie, and thank you for traveling away to be here today. I have one question regarding to your last map. With that $35 million, and you said it looks like about 70 applicants, it looks like the amount for in the past years in 2014, 2015, but it looks like per year there are about 14 or 15 plays that popped up, give or take. Is that what's to be expected with this $35 million, or is there any type of estimate you can give in terms of how that gets spread and across how many site locations? Ms. McKenzie?
Chair members, unfortunately, I don't feel comfortable predicting because with the different size in the pool this time, we've attracted, and it's now the third round, so providers are learning how to apply this tool differently. I'm seeing by flipping through the pile, I saw a grant request as small as $26,000 and one as large as $5 million. So it's going to be very, which is the cap, so hard to predict with this.
Okay, thank you so much. Members, other questions? Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious how many providers are we actually working in Minnesota and on the same map that was referenced. It talks about public-private partnerships, 8 in 2014, 6 in 2015, and that actually indicate the number of providers that are working in Minnesota.
Ms. McKenzie.
Madam Chair, that participated in the program, we have approximately 125 broadband providers in the state. And we have that list available by county if people are looking more closely at what's happening in their regions.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you. Just a follow-up. And how many are actually participating in the grant program?
Ms. McKenzie.
Madam Chair, that's a great question. I believe the number that you're looking at does indicate the number of providers. I think we're at 22 that are currently participating, and I also know that in that pile I saw a large number of new entrants that we will be evaluating for this round.
Senator Pittman?
Well, yeah, thank you. I think one of the thing I was thinking about was I know that we always have limitations. I mean, that's normal, limited funding, pretty good sized chunk of money this year, and $35 million, that's pretty remarkable, especially when it's leveraged with all the local private sources. But beyond that, what are some of the stumbling blocks yet that hinder the work of expanding this?
Ms. McKenzie.
Madam Chair, that is a good question. I think one of the things, unfortunately, the first ones that don't come to mind, that come to mind, are not necessarily legislative solutions. The their community awareness of what this resource means and what it is, and going through the assessment of what they need for their projected future is one of the things that we are seeing is making a difference in those communities that are moving forward. Is there's been some local awareness and a local champion stepping up. Obviously, the fact that the state's able to bring some tools to the table for them to use is extremely important. But local leadership, we're also seeing being
Senator Kipman.
Thank you. I think one of the particular issues, I held a broadband town hall last year. It was very interesting and has led to some information and also for folks in my community to get to know each other and know who's all out there. It was kind of interesting, the results in that. But one of the things we also found was a stumbling block in that realization that a particular company has fiber, but won't turn it on for their company and won't allow anybody else to have access to that. I consider that a really sad situation when you see the kind of resources that are there. Is this something that you have found? Is it just me? Or is there some effort going on to try and address that kind of a situation, whether it's incentives or regulatory changes?
Ms. McKenzie.
Yes, you do reference stumbling blocks that many communities across the state are facing, and it's that reconciliation of prior investments in infrastructure that may not be meeting current and future needs, and that the way that the industry has developed, and that there may not be robust competition in areas of the state, so that competitive pressure is not always in existence to help provide options for in those discussions that we are facing those issues. I think the state has chosen the incentive route, and that's how we are employing the grant program, is to try and use the grant program to work with some of those providers and maybe encourage them to come to the table. And in fact, we are seeing that happen. We are seeing providers who are not originally interested in making new investments come to the table because either this incentive is available or their neighbor is doing something, and which is causing, acting as a catalyst.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you so much for being here. And you know, just for members, I as well as others around the table worked quite a bit on telehealth a couple years ago. But obviously, that legislation is rendered ineffective if areas around the state don't have the resources and broadband tools in order to implement that. And if you overlap some of the maps from workforce shortages in rural areas and overlap that with your maps of broadband shortages, there's a lot of commonalities in those areas, and so it's double whammy for those folks who might have limited access to providers that they need, specialty that they need, as well as limited access to broadband that would help them be able to connect with the specialists that they need in parts of the state where they tend to be more densely located. And so we appreciate the work that you're doing on this. This is your presentation is a little bit outside of what we usually talk about in this committee, but it's very helpful to understand the telehealth issue, and I'm sure folks in Health and Human Services will continue to take an interest in the broadband issue as it relates to telehealth and trying to eliminate shortages for access for primary care, specialty care, things of that nature. Because in our telehealth discussions, we realize how big of a tool it could be for healthcare down the road for the people in the rural areas. So we appreciate it very much. Thank you for making the long trip.
Thank you.
And members, we do have one other testifier on this issue. Actually on the phone, we have Amanda Bell from Avera eCare. Are you there, Ms. Bell?
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee, for the opportunity to speak with you all today. I'm Amy Bell. I work with Avera Health, based out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I represent Avera's telemedicine efforts across their entire health system here. Avera has invested in telemedicine as a way to serve their own needs as a health system, but then has begun offering those services outside of our traditional bricks and mortar footprint to hospitals, clinics, and long-term care facilities in 12 additional states, I should say. So I think there is a video queued up to highlight the work that we do, but as a little introduction, I'd like to say that Barrett Telemedicine efforts are a little unique in that they were directly in response to our own health system's rural healthcare workforce shortages. In operating our 30-some hospitals and hundreds of clinics, we saw that we had significant staffing challenges every day, whether that was from a physician perspective, being practice providers, nurses, pharmacists, PAs. It is difficult to recruit and retain talent into very rural and frontier communities. So telemedicine has been a key strategy for our health system, both to better leverage specific specialists across a large geography, but also, and perhaps more importantly, to support our rural community in their efforts to recruit and retain those types of clinicians. We've worked very hard to give telemedicine as a backup to the support network, so clinicians, and make sure they feel very confident and comfortable in the clinical practice. So with that, I think I heard the video is ready to go.
Thank you, Ms. Bell. It is ready. We'll watch it now.
Avera Health is a sponsored health ministry started by the Benedictine sisters. And the presentation sisters really in the late 1800s, predominantly focusing in eastern South Dakota and some of the surrounding states. eCare, we have found over the years, has really given us a tremendous tool to take some of the specialized physician practices that we work with and really extend them out to a very remote area. We've been able to go beyond the traditional telehealth.
What we've done in eCare services, we actually have all of the specialists under one roof. So we have a virtual hospital. We have e-emergency, e-pharmacy, e-ICU, all together under one roof, really taking care of our rural population.
In terms of benefiting you as a physician, the biggest thing for eCare is having the support of a greater network of physicians. You know, when you're in rural America, sometimes you feel a bit isolated, a bit alone. And so having a greater network of support behind you is invaluable.
The virtual hospital concept is very simple. We are taking disparate programs such as ICU, emergency, pharmacy, correctional, or urgent care, and putting them into one building. That synergy allows us to take care of many different patients at the same time and have some cost efficiency while doing that. Our coverage area allows us to cover thousands of lives, in fact, millions of lives, in a square mile that is about the equivalent of France and Germany combined.
E-emergency is a telemedicine device where, at the touch of a button, the facility that uses us can have a board-certified emergency physician actually at the bedside as part of their team within virtually seconds. We also have a critical care nurse with us that can assist with any emergency situation. I chose to be an e-emergency physician because I grew up in a rural area and worked as a basic EMT for 9 years. And when I went to residency, I saw a whole new way of emergency medicine. And so when I had the opportunity to come and do this, this was a situation where I could bring that kind of emergency care back to rural America. One of my favorite stories from the emergency was there was an explosion with 5 casualties, so 5 patients who came, and there was a moonlighting survivor there. She had 2 nurses and 5 injured patients, 2 critically wounded. So she was able to stay at the bedside while we deployed aircraft, helped her to figure out how to gain access for these patients, helped them to get their way.
In an emergent situation where you need a lot of help and hurry, you utilize the emergency to call somebody there, and to have a board-certified emergency room doc over your shoulder is extremely reassuring and extremely powerful.
E-pharmacy is rather interesting. The actual order comes into our hub, and we have a hospital-trained pharmacist actually looking at each and every one of their patients who they receive an order from. The technology behind that is they have what is called an automated dispensing machine. The pharmacist actually programs that machine to have that medication available to the nurse when she comes and puts in the patient's name, puts her fingerprint on the machine. It calls up the patient's name, and her, she types it in. All of the medications that are ordered to that patient are listed for her. She selects the right one. That door pops open, and that's the only medication that's available for her to pull for that patient. Greatly increases the safety of the medication dispensing for that patient.
EICU, in its easiest description, is somewhat like air traffic control. In the background, the EICU is able to continuously monitor patients. That monitoring of those patients is done with some decision support software and some support staff, such as nursing and physician support. And that allows us to do population management of looking through hundreds of patients, literally looking for those that are having negative trends or perhaps might have a small change in their health status that may not have been able to be recognized by the bedside team. The Averity Access Program is our umbrella program for our on-demand urgent care platforms. We do this on-demand, not direct to consumer, but to other entities such as long-term care facilities or correctional facilities. What that allows us to do is really provide that care in the location in which that patient resides and help avoid transfers.
Providers in people's lives across technology will only grow.
I think what you'll see, our first step going forward, is adding new services, e-sepsis, e-stroke.
Our future is perhaps looking at a model like this e-helm that we're sitting in now and reproducing that across the country and across the globe.
From the patient's perspective, I think it provides that reassurance that the same brand promise, the same quality that we guarantee in maybe some of our larger centers is also available to you in the smaller rural centers.
I think about what the future is here.
Because we've just begun to scratch the surface of my mind.
We're continually looking at what we can do and get out there that actually increases the quality of care that people in rural areas have.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Bell. That was helpful to get us more of an idea of how things work. Did you have more to your testimony?
I would like to add just a couple of comments, and I think that is really the power of this type of telemedicine available around the clock to really support clinicians as they practice in rural America. And what we see in many of the hospitals and clinics that we work in, they've been able to recruit general practice nurses really to serve all of the healthcare needs of their community. So not just Monday through Friday in the clinic, but also as part of the hospital staff for any administration. They cover the emergency room, they cover the long-term care facility. And that's a pretty long job description and can be challenging to recruit into, especially with a younger cohort of physicians. What we found is that linking telemedicine with these recruitment efforts has been very effective. I think that practitioners feel like they'll have somebody to lean on if they don't know the answer to a particular question or situation up here that won't judge them, but rather be very supportive in their care, especially in the case of an emergency or more acute event. We've actually published some research on this in rural and rural health, and up to 81% of the providers and clinicians that were surveyed as part of a third-party group said that they felt that this type of telemedicine helped recruit and retrain team-specific clinicians in their community. So 4 out of 5 clinicians that were polled really felt like this does make a difference. And when you talk to them, it becomes more obvious. They have stories of really acute events, multiple vision car accidents coming into the ER, feeling very overwhelmed, wondering exactly if they're up to that challenge and what they got themselves into, and then they have us here with them through that case, telling them you're doing all the right things, you've got the base covered, what do you think about this? And that gives them an enormous peace of mind. It really helps reduce burnout in that job, and it makes them much more attractive for new graduates that are in these work positions with less experience. Many of the hospitals we work with today are using advanced practice providers that are coming right out of their training program as their frontline staff who are in the emergency room.
And for those advanced practice providers, if they've gone to the family practice team course, they've only had, you know, several weeks of experience in the emergency room before they come into clinical practice. So that's very intimidating. They want to feel confident and comfortable in the care they're getting. And telemedicine is one way that we can help make that possible. So I don't know that that was our intention exactly when we started out on our telemedicine journey, you know, over a couple decades ago. It was really about how do you bring specialists to the patient, wherever they might be, and help them through quality of care. And we've certainly seen that as well. But from a workforce perspective, we see this as a very powerful tool for how we can help hospitals recruit and retain. Drive down the cost of staffing and using local time positions and really provide top quality care to our patients. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. Members, are there any questions or comments? I don't see any at this time, Ms. Bell, but really appreciate the firsthand information from your experience. I'm sure you'll continue to be a point of reference as we continue to move forward on this issue. Thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, members, with that concludes our agenda for today. I do want to just give a chance. Is there anyone from the public in the audience who had any comments that they wanted to come forth and offer today to the committee? Not seeing any. Members, any final questions or comments? Yay. Okay, members, just as a reminder, our next meeting will be November 14th from 12:30 until 2:30. And with that, members, we are adjourned.